Hello, everyone, and thank you to this episode of the WTR Sustainable Investing Podcast. Welcome to Gibo today. We're having Gibo back on. We're going to have some great conversations with Eric Frey and Lindsay Fitzgerald. My name is Sean Severson, CEO of Water Tower Research and head of Energy Transition and Sustainable Investing. Thanks to everyone for listening today. As a reminder, you can find research on Gibo as well as other companies across all of our research categories at www.watertowerresearch.com. And I'd encourage you to check that out where you can get a lot more information on Gibo and check out prior fireside chats, research notes, and podcasts there as well. So again, I have my colleague with me here today, Peter. I'm going to turn over to you for a quick introduction. He's a fellow analyst and colleague of mine at Water Tower Research who's joining us today for our podcast. Peter.
Hey, thanks, Sean. So yes, I'm an analyst here at WTR, and I look at both energy transition as well as traditional energy sectors. It's really great to be here today, and I'm really happy to be able to join this conversation with Lindsay and Eric.
And so back to you, start with you, Eric, I guess, from backgrounds. But as you know, our topic today, we're going to have some really interesting stuff. Lots happening on the sustainable aviation fuel tax credit. We're going to be spending some time on that on 40B. But before that, I want to turn it over to you, Eric, talk about your background and introduce Lindsay and learn a little bit more about her as well.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having us back on, Sean and Peter. My name is Eric Frey. I'm VP of Finance and Strategy here at Gibo. I also am responsible for investor relations here. So I've done a couple of these podcasts and virtual analyst days and had different folks from Gibo come and talk to people about different aspects of our company, our business. So I'll let Lindsay Fitzgerald introduce herself, but she's vice president of government affairs and leads our government affairs effort at Gibo, which is a really, you know, critical part of our business and our strategy because everything we do is low carbon. And that goes hand in hand with both corporate demand and policy support. So I'll let Lindsay introduce herself.
Thanks, Eric. So thank you all for having me today. So Lindsay Fitzgerald, Vice President of Government Relations with Gibo. Last week was a pretty awesome week. I hit my 3-year mark. We got 40B guidance and I got to meet Bill Nye, the science guy. So I'm going to call it a good 3 years. For just a little background on myself, I started off in DC in 2004. And in 2007, 2 weeks after the RFS, Renewable Fuel Standard, was implemented, I started at EPA as a contractor, handed me a pile of the regulations in paper and said, read this, you're going to go answer questions on how people comply with this. And that was the start of my renewable fuels time in DC. I've had the pleasure of spending a number of years with EPA and then venturing out into the space with the Clean Fuels Alliance America, who was National Biodiesel Board, and Renewable Energy Group. So I've spent a lot of time in the biodiesel, renewable diesel space, but had the opportunity to come join Gibo and oversee and strategize for all of government relations around the world. And it's been an amazing 3 years. So last week was a cap in the right direction.
Great. Thank you for that, Lindsay. And thank you for coming on. Very exciting. Obviously, it's become a critical role at Gibo, looking at some of the things that I know the investors are eager to learn about and hear about updates there. But clearly, regulatory environment and so many things have been on the horizon and policy changes. So thank you for joining us today. I think we have a great topic to work with. So I'm going to jump right into the meaty part of this and 40B, right? Sustainable Aviation Fuel Tax Credit. Some updates last week. Investors are certainly eager to hear what your thoughts are on that. And also, you know, we'll talk a little bit about how this overall impacts Gibo, because it's an important topic for all investors across sustainability.
Yeah, so 40B was a huge step in the right direction last week. So we have been advocating around a SAF tax credit in some form for the past 2.5 years, really. And this gave us a lot of the things, or put into place a lot of the things that we've been asking for. So we wanted to see clear, accurate, up-to-date carbon accounting with the use of the Argonne GREET model. Check. We wanted to see inclusion of decarbonization strategies like carbon capture and sequestration. Check. We wanted to see that value going to farmers and incentivizing the agricultural community through climate smart ag practice inclusion. Check. I will lead into the next area and say it is not perfect, but it is a step in the right direction because these things were not in place prior to last week. And these are all areas that Gevo thinks about as we look at building our facility and as we look at how we plan to incentivize the whole supply chain.
So for those that are new to this, maybe a little description of what 40B is. And I know it's been a long runway trying to get to this one. You know, it's been something that's been around the corner for a little while. But I think, Lindsay, if you could talk more about what it is, so investors also understand, you know, what has happened here, and obviously the history that's led up to this.
Sure. So, history-wise, 3 years ago I started, and we had a tax credit that was a dollar blender's tax credit for biodiesel, renewable diesel, kerosene was included. It was a blender's credit, wasn't based on CI score at all. And we then had the Inflation Reduction Act, and that included two tax credits for sustainable aviation fuel. It included the 40B credit for 2023 and 2024, and it included the Clean Fuel Production Credit, the 45Z, for 25, 26, and 27. And this is the first time that a tax credit, has been really linked to the carbon intensity of the fuel. So this was a big step in the right direction for companies like Gevo and how we really are focusing on the carbon intensity of our fuel and the whole carbon intensity of the life cycle of where we're starting from the field all the way to flight or wherever that fuel was combusted.
And I guess the history from an investor standpoint is they've been waiting for this because it does impact the overall CI score and the value of SAF, right? I mean, and so it's important precursor, let's call it, to NZ1 and building a plant and getting all of that done that we've all been, you know, looking at for the runway of the inputs, let's say, into NZ1. So I think it's important investors understand that this was part of the input to NZ1. And not to get too far off track, but Eric, I think maybe if you could talk just briefly about what the various parts are that create that CI score so investors can understand how this fits in, especially at the on the agriculture side and the feedstock side.
Yeah, sure. So really, really briefly, because we start with biomass, the process has the potential to be net zero or even negative, or it could be, depending on number of factors, it could be a positive carbon footprint, but still a big reduction in carbon intensity versus fossil jet fuel. Net zero one, we're targeting based on the plant design, an electrified plant design with options for carbon capture and climate smart agriculture. A zero to slightly negative carbon intensity, that's our target. We might be a little more or a little less than that, depending on a whole bunch of factors. But we're targeting a significant reduction to fossil fuels. There are a number of things that give us a return on that capital. You know, we think the production cost can be competitive actually with fossil fuel, depending on a number of assumptions. But it's the return on that capital that we need to form to build, and that. That comes from things like the 45Z SAF tax credit. Just to give investors a sense of scope, you know, our capacity that we're targeting at net zero one is about 60 million gallons a year of SAF, plus some renewable diesel and bio-naphtha. If the credit is $1.75 a gallon for if you reach a net zero carbon intensity, then that's over $100 million per year of value to the plant. If we're less than net zero, if we're not as good as net zero, then it'll be less than $1.75 a gallon. But the point is that that's a very significant potential value, and that's why it's so important to us, to our lender, to our customers, that we know precisely what that is, and also that we have a plan that gets you well into that strike zone, so that okay, we can't predict the future precisely, but we know that we're going to be earning as much of that credit as possible. and doing it cost effectively with a process that is capable of cost effectively reducing carbon intensity because of the purpose-built plant design itself.
And what, so if we look at the opportunity, there's opportunities to reduce carbon in the way something is farmed, right? The way it's grown, which I'd like to ask a couple more questions about that. Then there's the plant itself, where you might be using RNG or renewables, right, from an energy source standpoint to reduce the carbon footprint. So it's critical, I think, investors understand that agriculture is a great opportunity to reduce the CI score as well, right? I mean, in addition to things I think people are more familiar with, which would be solar, RNG, wind, energy storage, that type of stuff, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there's a number of ways it could shake out, but the most important thing is that we've seen preliminary data. It depends on the field, but we've seen data from our Verity and Grower program that some climate smart ag practices can get you a carbon abatement or carbon reduction versus national average farming practices that is similar in magnitude to the carbon abatement that you get from carbon capture. And so what that means is that it's very significant. It has the potential to be very significant, and it also is very cost effective. In many cases, farmers are already using climate smart ag practices. It's just you can't get any value for that unless you track it in a way that's auditable. And that's fundamental to both our Net Zero One plant and to Verity tracking.
And I think that's really important what you just said, Eric, is that today we have USDA has programs in place that are incentivizing farmers to implement climate smart ag practices, what works for them where they are. And Gevo looks at that as an opportunity to meet farmers where they are with what they're doing on their field that enhances, using less fertilizer. Reduces runoff, planting cover crops, using low till or no till, depending on where they are and what they're doing. We can meet them where they are and help them recognize the value of what they're doing, in addition to just the commodities that they're producing, in addition to savings that they are seeing because of reduced inputs. We're now able to take a climate smart commodity and apply it to another program. So this is really the first time that you're seeing this kind of recognition of what the left hand is doing to what the right hand is doing. USDA is asking farmers to do these things, and now we have a program through Treasury that is recognizing those benefits through the chain. So you could still use corn starch to produce ethanol to produce jet fuel, or you could still use soy to produce jet fuel. But you get that additional credit reduction today if they're able to bundle these properties, then you have a climate smart commodity. In the future, we really want to see an expansion of what farmers are able to do, not necessarily requiring them to bundle and giving them more opportunities to say there is a whole menu of options for you as a farmer that you could implement to reduce the CI of your product. And you should be able to pick and choose what you want to do and what works for you where you are. And there should be an auditable, measurable way to go through and value that. And we believe that that's something that Verity is easily able to do to work with the farmers to make it the most efficient, the most efficient possible for them to implement. The most efficient and the easiest, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, Lindsay, I'd just like to follow up. You mentioned how 40B is essentially a good step, and I understand it will be expiring toward the end of this year. But then beyond that, you have potential for the 45Z. I wonder if you could sort of, give our listeners a little bit of, color about what that step means and what the future may hold with 45Z.
Sure. So 45Z, will start at this point. It will start on January 1st of 2025. We have shifted already to pivot towards what will the modeling look like under 45Z, and we really view what we have today as that jumping off point. So again, how can we enlist more climate smart ag practices that are not bundled, that are more of a pick and choose sort of model for the agricultural community. We want to enable our agricultural community to be engaged and involved in this space. This is how we take steps in the right direction to do that. We want to ensure that the most decarbonization or defossilization methods are able to be used in a facility. So, can you use RNG to lower the CI of your plant? Can that RNG be from more than just brand new RNG facility at a landfill? It should be able to be a, dairy RNG. It should be able to be any form of RNG that's out there. How is the hydrogen being accounted for? Is it hydrogen that is, in our case, ideally this hydrogen is coming from the excess wind? How is that being counted? Is it direct connect? Can you do book and claim for some of these things? So these are all opportunities that we are looking at to get kind of better understanding in 45Z, but also we want to be able to recognize the most carbon savings possible.
If I could go back to the question on the agricultural side, why is a farmer even incentivized to do this? I guess a simpler way of putting it is, what do they get out of it if they're working with you? Let's say they're using Verity, for example, and they're doing this. How do they benefit from this?
So I'll start and then Eric, jump in and help. But today, under the rules, if you're bundling these three practices for climate smart corn, for example, and you have all of the record keeping and documentation that's required, you get a 10 CI reduction. That is value in terms of the tax credit. So there is a dollar amount associated with this. And we know from history of, say, the biodiesel blender's credit, that traditionally was shared through the farmer, the blender, the renewable fuel producer. And I see that this is not going to be much different from how those credits have been handled in the past. This is what people know. So if you're able to supply a lower CI corn that gets a company a better amount of that tax credit, you likely will receive more benefit for that for your product than someone who is not getting that company an additional CI benefit.
So it becomes almost a premium crop, so to speak, in terms, because it's more valuable to the user, more valuable to the CI score for the SAF or whatever might be being produced from that, correct?
That is how we look at it.
Yeah, and I'll just add, remember, the thing that we think is really cool about what we're doing is, reducing carbon footprint is a really hard problem. And the traditional way of looking at it is, well, we've got cheap energy that pollutes, that is greenhouse gas emissions, and then we have really expensive energy that's clean, and that's just the choice. What we're trying to do is make it clean and cheap, and the way you do that, one of the ways you do that is you have multiple second and third order impact benefits of what you're doing. So, for example, many farmers have adopted these practices that Lindsay talked about anyway, because it's better for soil health, it reduces erosion. They can increase yield. If you produce more bushels per acre, that's good for you as a farmer. If you reduce your fertilizer use or your chemical inputs, they don't want to use more than they have to. Of course, they want to limit that as much as possible. That's good for growing food. It's good for their business. It's also good for greenhouse gas footprint. But farmers are they have their growing seasons, and a lot of them inherited farms from, their moms and dads and that kind of thing. And you can imagine farmers are risk averse. So even though there's been tremendous improvements in the United States and elsewhere in agricultural practices, yields have just the same amount of acres were planted about 100 years ago as today, but enormous much amount of growth in corn has occurred because of all these cumulative little improvements. Well, we can accelerate the adoption of those improvements with data that allows farmers to have more confidence in what we're doing. Oh, okay, that worked really well in that field, but it didn't work so well in this other field, for example. And so that's a additional benefit that we should be doing anyway with agriculture, but it also reduces greenhouse gas footprint. So it's kind of a win-win, and it creates a cycle of continuous improvement and positive feedback.
And I know we've had conversations about it before, but I want to remind investors, Verity. I mean, this is this is a key part, and it's a solution for helping to track this. So if you could give the elevator overview, if you could, Eric, on Verity and how this ties into this, because it's a very interesting part of Gevo that ties into the overall CI score analysis.
Sure, I can, unless you want to, Lindsay. Sure. So Verity is basically it's sort of a software tech startup that Gevo started about 3 years ago because we needed it for Net Zero One. Our management team in their past life invented pyrolactic acid, which was another sort of similar process. You start from biomass crops and you do fermentation and you make a substitute for a fossil chemical. Here, similar idea, except instead of making a plastic substitute, it's a fuel substitute. And in that from that former life, our management team knows that you have to give the customer an audit trail. So if they pay for something that's clean, they want to know that it was clean, that they could audit it, not only that it reduced carbon footprint, but that it had other sustainability attributes, right? You didn't cut down a forest, recently to make that farm, because then that wouldn't really be sustainable. So we knew we needed that anyway. So we started Verity. Well, it turns out that lots of farmers and ethanol plants in the US want that too, that are already operating before our Net Zero One plant. So Verity has sort of taken on a life of its own, where it's now signing up, it's signed up three customers. About 2% of the US ethanol industry by volume is now a customer of Verity. The tool went live last year. And what we're doing is basically, it's essentially software that gets paid through software as a service fees, and profit sharing in the carbon value that's enabled by tracking everything from the field, the individual field where crops are grown, through the manufacturing process to the seat in a vehicle or on an aircraft.
And Lindsay, you're kind of in the trenches on this, fighting this battle out there every day. What are you seeing as the key focuses that you're picking up from either from the government side and from the farm or from the agricultural community? I mean, what are the things that they're caring about today and focusing on today, and really that is driving this forward? And I assume there's a lot of different entities at work here, right? A lot of different pushes and pulls. But what's your take on the overall environment today, and maybe compare and contrast with a year ago, and where things you think are going in the next year?
So that was a loaded question. So I think first and foremost, the agricultural space really felt, I don't think they were thrilled with how 40B landed. They were really hoping that the writing on the walls from USDA with climate smart commodities programs and all of these incentives out there to implement climate smart ag practices on your field, that there would be more inclusion within this credit. But we're in May, and for a credit that's over at the end of the year. So right now, the shift in the agricultural community is, okay, come June or July, I need to be thinking about how I'm going to handle my fields after I harvest September, October. What am I doing with fertilizer? Am I doing no-till or low-till? What cover crops do I need to get ready to plant? All of those things need to be rolling in order to be thinking about what is going to happen on that field for the next growing season. In addition, they're working with companies that are still buying their commodity today. So they may have corn or soy or something that is left from this growing year that they still haven't sold yet. So is there a mad scramble to, do I have all the documentation that I need to meet this requirement? And maybe I do have some feedstock that could qualify for 40B if someone is out there that could take it and process it. So that's kind of one aspect. Another aspect is who can we talk to help them understand what practices work where? So again, maybe no-till doesn't work everywhere, but low-till does. How can we be really clear about what that means and what that looks like? Cover crops. Do they work everywhere? Can you harvest your cover crops for seed? That's something that a lot of farmers actually do. And so, how do we make sure that what is in 45Z as allowable, countable towards CI is actually practical for the agricultural community? It's something that they're doing. So that's on the ag side. On the producer side, on the industry side, we're looking at, okay, the next credit 45Z, how do we get this implemented right? How do we get guidance out soon? We know there's going to be a request for information coming out from likely USDA, maybe DOE in the coming months. How can we get information to them again so that more decarbonization strategies can be included in a menu sort of way, not in a prescriptive way? And I would say that the third and final thing is, what is our next opportunity for a credit extension? So this next credit is only 3 years. How do we get this to be a 10-year credit? How do we get this to be in line and consistent with other big tax credits for renewables so that it is more in line with the investment needed and the time to build and bring new infrastructure online? Those are the things that we're all looking forward. And there's this thing happening in November, minor details, and how
Yeah.
that plays out will determine, I think, how things move forward. And if anybody tells you that they know November, if November turns out this way, this will happen and vice versa, they're full of it. So we're all kind of looking at this, and there's a number of options of how things can play out depending on what happens in November, and we're working all of those avenues all the time.
One of the things that seems interesting this time around is it seems like agriculture is getting on board, understanding the value in this. And maybe that's a different perception or a sea change. If you look at the agricultural lobby, for example, it's a powerful lobby, right? And if they want this, it certainly helps to incentivize politicians and other people who are making some rules on this. Am I correct in thinking that, because they're able to benefit from the way they're growing from these processes and growing practices, there's money, right? We all like to be green, but we really want to be green for the sake of some cash, right? Not just to save the world. So they're aligned in this, if I'm understanding it correctly, in terms of
Yeah,
why they're.
so I mean, yeah, I think we are all generally rowing in the same direction on this, because farmers understand that there will always be volatility in agriculture. And so the more opportunities you have to kind of reduce that volatility is a really good thing. So we're implementing these practices because it'll help my field be stronger in the event that there's some crazy, I don't know, a derecho, if something comes through. We're insulating ourselves that way. We now are expanding on the markets that our product can go to. Is it going to on-road use? Is it going to sustainable aviation fuel? And now there's a market for the carbon intensity of our product as well, in addition to for corn, the distillers grain, the corn oil. We're just broadening the market bases, which gives them more stability. So yeah, I think, we're rowing in the same direction. We want to see these policies continue and improve and expand.
And I'm going to jump back. I know you talked a little bit about Eric on the economics of this, but I just wanted to circle back. Why do investors care that this happened or didn't happen? I want to reiterate that so that they can really understand why this is important and where it's going. So I know you talked a little about the production and the $1.75, but if you go back and break that down a little bit, I'd like to revisit that.
Yeah, sure. So just to emphasize that, it's really two things. One is the magnitude of the credit for us is very substantial, because we're not just looking to make sustainable aviation fuel. We're looking to make it in a way that abates a lot of carbon cost effectively. And so if that's your strategy, then a tax credit that rewards you and goes up and increases depending on how much carbon abatement you succeed in doing, is extra valuable to us. Again, to quantify it, $1.75 a gallon of SAF would imply, once Net Zero One is operating, over $100 million of value if we get to net zero, which is our target. Our target is actually just a little bit under net zero. Even if we don't hit net zero, we still abate a lot of carbon, and that's still a significant number for us, which we've long expected value for our carbon abatement through a number of different mechanisms. But this is a very visible mechanism that everybody can point to and see, and we have to have certainty about it, some degree of certainty about it, to do our lending process and financing for the building the project. That's number one. Number two is that we also believe that we had, we're to some extent proud that we had the foresight years ago to have a purpose-built plant that gets you well into that strike zone. If you just built an off-the-shelf ethanol plant design with an off-the-shelf unit operations to convert ethanol to jet fuel, and you didn't try to design the plant to use wind power and to reduce its consumption of fossil methane and to integrate the plant to reduce its energy footprint, if you didn't try to do all those things, you wouldn't get this tax credit. You wouldn't abate enough carbon to get there. You might abate some carbon relative to fossil fuel, but you wouldn't have enough to qualify. The majority, about 60 points of carbon intensity. So fossil fuels, fossil jet fuel is about somewhere about 90 points of carbon intensity is the way to think about it. We get something like a 50 to 60 point reduction just from the plant design being a wind powered plant. It'll be connected to the electric grid because wind is intermittent, but it's designed so that all or most of the electric power consumed by the plant is wind, and as much energy as possible uses electric power. So that right there gets you well into the zip code of qualifying for the credit. Then, in addition, we have these options to do carbon capture, to use climate smart agriculture, and then to bring in biogas, which we think very comfortably will get us into that zero or negative, could be very negative range. If certain things go differently, we could be positive and not at zero or negative. But the point is that we're really competitively positioned, we think, relative to almost any other renewable fuels company that's out there. And we're not using new technology. We just put the effort on the front end to have a purpose-built plant design that is low carbon.
And I'd also highlight that a lot of that is in your control, like using wind and RNG, and the economics of the plant aren't dependent on climate smart agriculture, for example. I mean, and when I say dependent, you can still qualify. There's still a return. I don't want people to have the misperception that, well, if they have to have this in order to have the plant or get the DOE loan. I think adding some perspective around that would be helpful, Eric, just to talk about these are great additions to the C, or I guess just reductions, let's say, to the CI score through the additions of these other things. But these aren't, in and of themselves, those aren't make or break type incentives.
There are two slide decks on our investor relations website. One is our sort of corporate presentation, and the other is what we call our deep dive. And in the deep dive, you'll see an updated version of the slide that we call the carbon intensity walk. And it shows you, okay, if you started like a 90 carbon intensity for fossil jet fuel, what are all the things that we do in Net Zero One to target zero or negative? And what we do is we highlight on that slide, here's the bucket of things that are just intrinsic to the plant design that are not really variable, if that makes sense. And then here are the things that are more variable. Like, for example, the precise timing of a carbon capture pipeline will determine the timing of when we have CCS and when we get carbon abatement from CCS. The precise agricultural practices that farmers choose to use and how they're counted will impact the magnitude of climate smart ag. But the point is that that intrinsic plant design carbon reduction that you get just right off the bat puts us in a really good spot where there's all these paths for us to be successful that don't hinge on one single thing that has to go our way. There's just many ways for us to succeed in reducing and abating carbon and for that to make the plant economic, basically. But there's also lots of ways for there to be upside from that. And critically, it's in a cost-effective way. These are things that are not, we're not putting a square peg in a round hole by buying climate smart ag. We chose the location in Lake Preston because 70% of the farms up there, according to our survey, already used less than conventional tillage practices, for example. South Dakota has a lot of wind, so it's a good place to have a wind farm. It's just there's not much demand for wind. But if we build an electrified plant, now it makes sense to exploit that natural wind that's there. So we're doing things that are natural to do, if that makes sense. And we think it the way these regs are shaking out with the 40B puts us in a very competitive position to have a plant design and a business model that's repeatable.
And Lindsay, I have one last question for you, and then we'll wrap it up today. Not asking you to look in your crystal ball to provide answers or outcomes, let's say, but when in your world, what are the things on the horizon that are important to you and important to Gevo? Again, not asking about what you think the outcomes are, but what are the events or things that are happening that investors need to be watching for, looking for updates? We'd love to have you back in as we get through some of these other milestones. But what are those milestones that we need to be watching?
So, I mean, I think from a government sort of perspective, looking for when are we going to start to see something on 45Z, whether that's through a request for information coming out and taking note of, how are Gevo and others commenting on this? I would love to see that guidance actually be wrapped and final before the end of the year, so that people know how they can move forward. So keeping an eye from the federal side there. There's a number of things happening in the states right now as well that is worth watching and we are actively engaging in. So whether it's California, Washington State, Minnesota, Michigan, New York, Massachusetts, there's a whole lot of state policies going on, and that's a coffee talk for another day, and how those things are moving forward. Will we see actual progress this year beyond New Mexico? I don't know. I would love to say yes. And then to kind of broaden it out, we've got elections going on in Europe in about a month. And so, we have a SAF mandate in Europe, and we're looking at how do we expand production? How do we keep moving forward where there are our markets? So I think it's keep reading the newspaper, keep staying tuned, and we'll keep talking about what we're doing. But I promise you that we are all over, and we are pushing this ball up the hill and making progress.
All right. Thank you for that, Lindsay. That's very helpful. And thank you, Eric, for joining us today as well. I think this is a great topic. Again, love to have you back because this is an ongoing dynamic situation, to say the least. And looking forward to more updates and having some additional conversations with you. Thank you, everyone, for listening to today's podcast. Again, you can access additional information on Gevo and other research at watertowerresearch.com. And thank you for subscribing to the podcast. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me and certainly to Eric as well at Gevo if you'd like to address any questions specifically to the company. With that, I'm going to conclude today's podcast. Again, thank you, everyone, and look forward to having you all back.